Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely and utterly surrounded by my stuff. I've been up to the attic, defied the pigeon with the gammy leg and the single white eye, and brought down my collection of White Dwarf magazines. It is a complete collection. As we all know, it finished publication at issue 107 when it stopped printing RPG material. I store mine in a Golden Wonder crisp box, where cheese and onion flavoured crisps are forever served in green packets, like things should be. On my right is my library of RPGs and my Grognard Files. Here on my left is the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Ah yes, this time the Eternal Champion has appeared as a journalist, asking questions and taking note of the answers from Adamant in Goody Two Shoes. We've had another lovely review. It's always cockle-warming to get a positive feedback about our endeavours, and I read them here as they often do a better job at explaining the podcast to new listeners than I can. This time it's from Bud, from Bud's RPG Reviews. He says, Dirk and Blythe calmly chat about role-playing games and the early days of the hobby. Their measured northern tones expresses a love of the hobby shared over decades. One of the must-listen gaming podcasts out there. Thanks, Bud. Reviews are always appreciated. This episode sees the return of our friend at Daily Dwarf from formerly known as Twitter, who has written a short essay that I'll read about the good, the bad and downright odd covers of White Dwarf from its heyday. He takes us on a tour of unforgettable images from those covers and picks out some of the highlights. If you'd like to play along and don't have your copies at your fingertips, then please follow the link in the show notes to Daily Dwarf's site, where he's very helpfully catalogued the covers. In the room of role-playing rambling, I'm joined by resident rules lawyer Judge Blythe as we cast a critical eye over some of our favourite covers. We've also asked the Grog Squad for some questions, and in the second half of the podcast, we'll answer them. I'll be back at the end to say goodbye, but until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Library use!
Welcome to the Zoom of role-playing rambling. I've got Blythe with me. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
How are you doing? We should be out and about. We should be having a JBO tonight, but because of reasons, we weren't able to do it.
So. We're not able to do it now, I know. But at least it's quiet for recording purposes.
Yes.
For some people will like.
Yeah. And, you know, I've got a beer with me. I've actually got in a kind of Virtuous. Which is what I normally drink, isn't it, when we're out in the bait?
That is your favoured beer from Port Street, isn't it? Virtuous.
Virtuous, yeah.
I don't like it. I find it a bit aromatic. It advertises itself as aromatic, doesn't it? But yeah. I don't like it. I don't like aromatic in my beer, whatever aromatic. I don't want aromatic in my beer. Leave the aromatics out of it.
It sounds like something you should be having in your bath, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, like they put a bath bomb in the distillery or whatever.
I quite enjoy it.
Mm.
In a sense, we're recreating lockdown JBOs, aren't we? We're actually out, but we're not out.
Yeah. Mm.
It's 4 years. As time of recording, it's 4 years since they actually announced lockdown.
Yeah, it was. God, yeah, it was this time, wasn't it? Range for your birthday, yeah.
To the day, almost. Because I think it actually started, the schools closed on the 23rd. We're recording this on the 20th.
Mm.
4 years ago. It's very strange, isn't it? Because it seems like the world changed from that moment.
but it's also stayed very much the same.
I don't think the world's, yeah, not really ever recovered from it in a way. Things change and have never quite become normal again in some respects, I think.
What I thought we'd do today is take down from the shelf some magazines looking at White Dwarf, because Daily Dwarf going to take us on a tour of the first 106 covers of White Dwarf. And I thought I'd ask you what your top three covers were. What were your favourites? Let's take it in turns.
Okay. All right. But,
so before we do that, why do you think the covers are significant? When you look at them now, what is it about the covers that have, in some ways, it's more enduring than the content?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I don't know. I suppose it's just stick in the memory, but sometimes stick in the memory for all the wrong reasons, let's face it. I mean, there's just quite a bit of inappropriate nudity and violence and gore, isn't there? Which I'm not sure you would necessarily get away with nowadays. Albeit, you know, obviously, White Dwarf for a long time was just a subscription-only thing. You didn't apart from in Games Workshop, you didn't really see it on the shelves of W.H. Smith. But I don't think some of it would... I don't think it'd be tolerated these days. Half-naked women summoning demons and things like that. I don't think that'd be tolerated. So in some respect...
I mean, you're saying nakedness and violence and gore as if it's a bad thing.
Well, yeah, true, yeah. I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing. What I'm saying is it would be possibly frowned upon if it was on the shelves of your local newsagents. I mean, you could sell illegal vape, but if they put things like that on the shelf, there'd be uproar, absolute uproar.
It's what you said about it being a subscription magazine. It's so true, because when I look at the span of these over the 106 that Daily Dwarf looks at, there is a cluster. When I get to my favourite, there is a cluster of a period of time when I was so invested in the magazine that it was like the pinnacle of the month. I've got specific memories of particular covers as being milestones for stuff I was doing at the time. But it was that feeling that it was some exclusivity about it. Yeah. And I still enjoy receiving post. And there was always that thrill of when that brown envelope with the little dwarf in the corner came through your letterbox, that it was like something fresh and new, and you look forward to it each month. And I think that's what is striking about the covers now. Those memorable moments, and... There's some nostalgic residue of the thrill of when it landed on your doormat.
Yeah, that's true. And also, I think some of the covers sort of intriguing as well. You do get odd and intriguing covers as well that you sometimes think, I'm not sure what's got to do with role-playing. Some of them tell a story, don't they, as well? Some of them are quite dramatic. And I can remember looking at some of the covers and thinking, oh, I wonder if you could incorporate that into a scenario in some way. So although you get weird ones where you think, like the one I'm thinking of, the one with the aliens with the long heads. Do you remember that one? Pink cover. Not one of the worst, I always thought. And you looked at it and you thought, what's that got to do with role-playing, really? I'm not sure. But others do have a sort of certain dramatic quality to them, don't they? The one I always think of is the one, I've got it on a T-shirt. It's issue 32. And it's the one with Lord of the Ring, the Tolkien D&D thing. And it's the one where there's like these guys who've crashed a plane. It looks like a spaceship. It's not a spaceship, but it's like a futuristic plane. And there's this kind of monster coming over the hill, attacking them or going to attack them. And it's quite a dramatic picture that you look at and think, oh yeah, you know, it kind of almost like gets you in the mood for role playing. I think they're the best. They're some of the best covers.
There's a similar one, isn't there? There's a similar one. I think it's issue 49 was a very salmon pink one, but there is a platform with like a space raft, sky raft, with people shooting at droids that running away, like a droid safari type thing. And that was something that is a very dramatic image. And as you say, something that you feel, I could incorporate this into a game.
Yes, I know the one you mean. Yeah, yeah. There's two robots that have been blown up, shot, and one's still running. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you looked at some of them and thought, yeah. I suppose you looked at it and thought, this is what these games are all about.
The thing that you forget now is you had no awareness of the earlier covers. So, you know, when we started getting it in the 30s, there's no sense of, you know, the first 10 or any of them, what was on the cover, because you never saw them. And it's only since the internet that you've got that retrospective to see how they move from the line drawings to the coloured images.
And you can kind of break them up, really. The more I think about it, you can break them up into maybe three types. There's the kind of action scenes that we've just talked about, where it's a scene where there's something dramatic going on, which makes you think of a scene from a game. You think, oh, I could use that in a game. Or it might be a springboard for an idea. And then there's others. One in particular of mine is a favourite, where it's like almost like an NPC. It's a character or a monster that you think you could use in a role-playing game. And then the third category is all the other weird bits that don't quite fit the other two, like the aliens with the long heads. And you think, well, sure about that.
When you think of the source of them, many of them have adorned other products such as books, haven't they? And games, very often, Games Workshop, if they were promoting a game, they would use the cover from the game and to highlight it. Mm. So there's quite a few like that, isn't it? But you're right, it's the ones that had character are the ones that were inspirational. I have very specific memories because at that time, we devoured the contents of them. So the magazine would go with us wherever we were. So when we went to school, I've got particular memories of number 39, which is the cover of a barbarian with a long mustache, two wolves by his side. Yeah. He's riding through the woods with the sunlight behind him. And I look at that, and a bit like when people say about music and how that can transport you to a particular time. I remember us sitting on a summer's day behind D Block at school with Brian Henson and Michael Holland talking away about some nonsense. And I was reading that it had Sleigh Grind on it. But it's that cover, and that cover that just transported me away and made me think about role-playing when I wasn't role-playing.
Yeah, you were role-playing, yeah. Yeah, it was. It was a strange thing, wasn't it? It was like a kind of touchstone that you'd carry around with you and read cover to cover. Yeah, because it was like some link to the outside world of role-playing that you didn't really have in those days. They didn't have a link to the outside world. Apart from going to Games Workshop and White Dwarf, that was it, wasn't it? You know, you didn't really know that anyone else was doing this.
And the fact of carrying it, again, to use a music analogy, it was like the moment when you took an LP underneath you and kind of project to people the person that you were. So by holding this magazine in a public space, you were making a statement about who you were and who you
are. Like carrying a copy of Socialist Worker to show your left wing or something like that. It's the same thing, is it? Sort of, I'm carrying a copy of White Dwarf. Look at me, I'm into role playing. Even though the rest of the world doesn't know what the hell it is.
D.D. Miles?
We spent so much time with them. Let's have a look at what your favourites then. I'll let you start then. What's your first one?
My first one is issue 19. And it's one that I didn't have. I think I ended up getting it, but I didn't have it early on because, as you said, they were difficult to get hold of, weren't they? I think I might have seen it at Odyssey 7 because Odyssey 7 used to sell back issues, didn't it, and things like that. And it's the one of a ghoul coming out of a hole in the ground. Issue 19. Yeah.
Ah, yeah, number 19, one by Les Edwards. I think that made an appearance later in Call of Cthulhu.
I think it did, yeah. But I think it falls into that category of, it's not like an action. I mean, it's kind of like an action scene. This thing coming out of a hole in the ground, like an Egyptian temple, isn't it? Kind of menacingly coming out of the ground. But it's one of those where it's like a great NPC or a great monster. done in a kind of dramatic way where you look at it and you think, I remember thinking, you know what, I wish my monsters looked like, oh, my monsters look like that when they're confronting the players. Kind of like a really menacing character.
It's the lighting in that one, isn't it? That's particularly dramatic, and the shadows, and because it's not very clear what the monster is. Absolutely, is it? Is it a goblin?
No,
is it a demon?
I think it's like a goblin or a ghoul or a demon or something, isn't it? It's like this long-limbed, bold thing with pointy ears, staring straight at you in kind of quite a dramatic way.
Oh yeah, that's a good one, and I suppose a similar one that I like, because I think Les Edwards does the necromancer one, the famous necromancer one for issue 35, but I've not picked that one.
You've not picked it?
I've not picked that one.
I picked that then. I picked this because it reminds me very much of the necromancer one. And I thought you're going to pick the necromancer because you've got it on a T-shirt.
I have got it on a T-shirt.
Oh, I thought you were going to pick that. Well, in that case, forget this. I'll pick the necromancer.
Our friend Chris Sharp also has it on a T-shirt. And as he points out, when I wear it, the necromancer leans backwards, which, you know, that going back to lockdown, it's leaning backwards even further than it did 4 years ago. But yeah.
I picked it. Then in that case, issue 35, the necromancer. I thought you were going to pick that. Why did you pick that?
I do like that image, but there is another necromancer image that I like better,
right.
Which is
I like that necromancer. And it's strange because I think the ghoul coming out of the hole is very similar. Is it the same artist?
It is the same artist. It's Les Edwards, similar tricks of the light.
It's very similar. The light, the colour, everything about it, the kind of staring straight at you, kind of menacing kind of figure. So, yeah, the necromancer is a great cover.
Yeah. Yes, that's a necromancer on issue 35. But, yeah, it's issue 38. They also have a necromancer on it. But this one's quite different, I think. It's done by Nicholas Bibby. And, again, for inspiration, oh, my goodness, I spent a long time looking at this image because it's got a necromancer at his desk. Almost like a homage to St. Jerome in his study, except he's this sinister figure with his long fingers knitted together in front of his face. And you keep staring at this image because each time you look at his study, his desk, more things are revealed to you. So, I mean, it's immediately apparent there's this severed head in front of him. But if you look closely, other things reveal themselves, like an orc's head, brass inkwell. And I think it was ages before I realised that there's a naked apprentice behind him. But you spend a lot of time looking at this image and I think it kind of beguiles you. It's a bit like a puzzle. You know, like that masquerade by that Kit Williams.
Yeah.
You know, you keep looking, you might find a clue to some sinister secret. But I love it. I love that image. And I find that so inspirational.
Yeah, agree. It is a great cover. I think I drew it in art. I think I tried to draw it in art, I think, that cover. I remember trying to draw several White Dwarf covers, probably very badly, in art classes. I think that was one of them. I certainly tried to draw the one that you referred to earlier with the guy walking through, riding through the forest.
I remember you doing that.
And I think I tried to draw this as well, or at least made a bit of an attempt at it. That suggests that my version of it looked like that. It didn't look like that. Would have been rubbish, but yeah.
Well, for me, it inspired me. It made me think about how a necromancer or a sorcerer would operate in the world and the artifacts that it surrounded itself with. And I think I got a bit obsessed with it, having a guild of necromancers, as though you would, as though they'd work together and have some kind of, I don't know, a trade union or something to protect the necromantic secret. It's a dying trade. Anyway, go on.
The NUN, National Union of Necromancers. I like it. My next choice is the cover from issue 51. 51, it's like bingo, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is a picture of a sorceress, a magic user, casting a kind of spell at an orc or an ogre or something in battle.
Well, this is an Ian McKeag, isn't it? It's almost like a callback to the image that he did for the Games Workshop RuneQuest.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And I think it's a great image because, again, it feels like it's about gaming, as if, you know, that's a player character casting a spell. But it's a battle scene. I suppose what I like about it is there's quite a few covers, obviously, that cover battles and fighting. But often, they don't look, I say realistic. I know none of it's realistic. But some of them are a bit daft. I remember looking at them as a kid and thinking, that's just daft, that. People don't fight like that. Whereas when I saw this cover, I thought, yeah, you know, that's what it would be like. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, good examples of what I'm thinking about are the one like cover, you might pick this, cover 54, for example, has a guy on horseback riding through the snow. It's a great picture. And he's got this huge sword across a horse, this huge sword. And you look at it and you think, what's that? What is that thing he's carrying? It's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. Whereas when you look at this picture, it feels like something from one of the games. Like, say, RuneQuest. He's casting disruption in RuneQuest or Magic Missile or something like that in D&D. That's what she's doing. So that's what
I think the thing we said when we saw this one was, of course, she's using a power storage crystal.
She is, isn't she? She's got a crystal in one hand, so it's like a power storage crystal. That's what I like about it.
My next one, and this might be one that we both pick, because I suppose this is one that has a significance to us in terms of our memories, because this is the one where the advert for the Armchair Adventurers, our group, was put in. And that's issue 46, which depicts a space station, well, a low-orbiting space station, which is white and got Gothic spires, and it's an interesting angle. There's some jets circling it, and beneath it, it's clearly depicting futuristic England, because beneath this space station and the surface, there is a patchwork quilt of a rural idyll. So that was always exciting. I think that is one that has certainly inspired some of our traveller games to see, this is what a space station could look like. Because it was, what's interesting about it is that it's a space station, but within the atmosphere of the planet.
Good, a great cover. Again, like a dramatic kind of cover that makes you look at it and ponder what's going on. And it feels like something that you could springboard a scenario off. You could look at that and think, well, what is that? What is that thing? Why are those planes there? What's going on? And build something out of it.
Yeah. And as I said, the space station is quite architectural, isn't it? It looks futuristic because it's white, but the actual buildings or the prominent aspects of it are Gothic. You've got that one on a t-shirt, haven't you?
I have got that on a t-shirt because, I thought it seemed appropriate given that it was the one that put us in touch with Eddie.
Okay, what have you got up next?
Well, there's two really, but again, I thought you might pick one of them. So the one I've gone for is issue 42, which is the picture of Irillion.
Oh, yeah. Blank one.
Yeah. Which, weirdly, if somebody said to me, why do I have cover? And I just had word association. What do I cover? The first thing I'd say would be this one. It would be this one. It sticks in my mind. I think it must have been. I mean, what issue? 42. Let's have a look at the actual date of publication of this. June 1983. That's the point. June 83 is probably the beginning of the kind of curve soaring up to peak RPG about 12 months later. So I think that's possibly why it sticks in my mind, that it's part of that phase. And also, a bit like your choice of the necromancer, there's a lot, quite a lot going on in the pictures, a lot to look at. You know, this city scene, like looking at it. It's, although it's kind of deserted sort of street, but there's a lot to look at, and it kind of draws you in. There's like a narrow alleyway leading through these big buildings with thatched roofs and pointed conical kind of chimneys and things like that. And it does kind of draws you in. And of course, at the time, city adventures became a big thing, didn't they?
Yes. Yeah.
We all wanted to run things in cities. Dungeons were so passé. That's the old world. Now we want to run adventures in cities. And this was all part of that, wasn't it? This was the kind of launch pad of the Aurelian campaign, which we never played, did we? We never used it, but the artwork on that cover, I really like it.
Yeah, we weren't allowed to because obviously we didn't have
D&D.
It was a preserve of Simon. And I think what Aurelian did by association, that cover, it kind of imposed itself on our imaginations of what city adventures were. And I think it is one of those, I don't like using this phrase, but iconic white dwarf covers, isn't it? It's one that is very striking. Yeah. As you say, the more you look at it, the more you discover. I really think that it was only recently that I realised that there was a house robber climbing up the rooftops.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's right. There he is, right at the top. Little silhouette, isn't it? Just near the F of the white dwarf, yeah.
The last one I'm going to go for is a Jim Burns one, which again is in this cluster that we've gone for around this period. Doesn't surprise me that we've chosen from this period and not some of the later ones. And it's number 43, which has a grey-skinned barbarians on chariots charging towards you with standing stones behind them. And they've got severed heads dangling from the side of the chariot as they stampede towards your direction, the sword drawn.
Yeah.
Very dramatic image and very evocative image that, honestly, that inspired so many encounters. I wanted to replicate that encounter, and what would the player characters do when facing that? When playing RuneQuest, obviously, it meant that you had your legs chopped off by them and your characters died at their hands. But I love this. I love that image.
Yeah. And that is one of those, again, that you come back, I come back to that thing, the dramatic image that you look at and think, oh yeah, I want to kind of put that in a game. The other one that I would have picked is issue 33, which is the little adventurer walking into this strange garden with all these odd little giant statues of animals, like a corridor and a full moon in the sky.
That was my first one. That was one of my first ones, and I think that's why.
I think that is why it has a certain resonance with me. I mean, I think it's a really evocative picture, like an atmospheric picture of a strange garden that you could, you know, an adventurer might kind of come into. There's like a pathway, isn't there, with the cobbles and a snake embedded into it. But I think it was the first one you bought, and I think that's why it's always stuck in my mind. Whenever I see it, I get a kind of strange, sort of slight goosebumps, really, because it's got Rumble in the Tin Inn, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And I remember sitting in your bedroom, your little box bedroom, looking at it, and I think that's why it kind of connects with me, because I think it's the first white dwarf I ever saw that. So
it's still, even though the familiarity of them over the years has probably diminished that feeling, I think it still does have like a residual thing about it when you see them, it does take you back. And even though, you know, I've got probably closer to the content now than I ever was, because even though I used to read the content, we never really used it, whereas I probably got more utility out of it over the past few years because I've been running adventures from these old copies of White Dwarf. But They still hold something. There's still something, even though I spent a lot of time with them. There's some magic in there.
And in terms of the scenarios, probably got more play inspiration from some of the covers than we did from the scenarios, like you say. So we didn't run the scenario. So that Irelium cover, we didn't use Irelium for the reasons you've explained, the Prime Directive. But that cover kind of inspired me and made me think about city adventures, what I wanted to do with this city adventure.
They weren't all great, though, were they? I mean, I've always had a bit of a problem, and you've mentioned one of these, Peter Andrew Jones. He's the guy who he did the Stormbringer cover for Games Workshop, and he always had this thing with proportion. They never looked quite right, and you mentioned the one with the wizard riding through the mist carrying a sword that was unfeasibly large and strange looking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You'd look at it and think, how's he even carrying it on the back of that horse? How's he even balancing it? What's he doing with it? You know, never mind the fact it's a big sword. It doesn't even, how would it stay where it is?
What I've noticed by looking at them, that I think he had an aversion to feet, because the lower half of his figures are always concealed by some vapor or smoke. And except in one, and this to me is one of the worst covers, which is number 59, which again is one that's prominent in my memory because it has a small ad for the PBM that I ran. And this one has a practically naked sorcerer woman holding a knife. You can't see her feet. They're concealed by vapor. Yeah. And then striding out from the darkness is this humongous demon figure who looks ridiculous because he's got a wig on, like with a centre parting. And his hooves look like shoes from Clark.
Yeah, it's like a weird toupee, hasn't it? Yeah.
It looks like it should have a gap between its teeth and glasses on, rain glasses. It looks like the class nerd in the form of a demon.
Someone back to exact revenge. Yeah. Yeah. And there is a bit, quite a bit of that, you know, naked. There's quite a few naked sorceresses, isn't there, on the front of White Dwarf. Whenever they're doing magic, gonna get all the clothes off. Take all your clothes off, because magic doesn't work. Who told you that?
And the only that stand out as you is a bit to you as being particularly bad.
Well, the pink aliens one. Although when the more I look at that now, the more I think it's that bad actually. It doesn't inspire you for role playing, does it? There's one with the scouts, and there's a woman in this kind of weird rubber cat suit. And you look at it and you think, what on earth? What were you thinking?
Yeah, I think that was Alan Craddock and number 27. There's a woman in a sprayed-on suit.
Yeah, and it's quite. I mean,
to be fair, he was a repeat offender. Alan Craddock.
He
did the one with fighting the demon, where she was wearing a chainmail bikini, and there's the one with a guy who looks like a Hell's Angel coming out of a spaceship being presented by barbarians, and a woman showing her bum cheeks.
Yeah, and there's another one as well that I think he did, looking at it. Alan Craddock. Yeah, there's another one with a woman in very, very scantily clad woman with two white kind of tigers or wolves' feet.
Yeah.
That's another one by him. So, yeah, let's say that clearly is like stock in trade, wasn't it? He was slightly disappointed in the end by what's inside when you get some scantily clad woman on the front of a magazine and open it to find the Monster Mark system inside. I think, there you go. Not what you're expecting, is it? Says them right, I suppose.
So that's what we thought of him. Let's see what Daily Dwarf thinks of him. I'm now going to read an essay from Daily Dwarf, and we'll be back for some Thunder Phase.
White Dwarf.
White Dwarf covers the good, the bad, and the downright odd.
Back in the day, each month I trudged through Cardiff city centre, excitement slowly building. As I neared the legendary friendly local game shop, FC Parker, the sense of anticipation would mount, undimmed by the stench from the nearby Brains Brewery, a smell that a friend of mine likened to an elephant house at London Zoo. On entering the shop, amid the tobacco-tinged gloom, it would shine out like a beacon, and my excitement level would max out as I saw, for the first time, the new White Dwarf cover. The covers of White Dwarf magazine, in a far-off RPG era, always created an indelible impression. So much so that even now, just the mention of an issue number conjures up the cover image to my mind. So I thought it would be fun to take a quick stroll along memory lane and review some of them together. Now, I'm aware of the difficulty of discussing a visual medium on a podcast, but what the heck? Break out the Golden Wonder crisp box, get out your collection and follow along. It'll be fun. And before we begin, though, a quick disclaimer. I'm no artist. In fact, I fell out of the artistic ability tree at a very young age and managed to avoid hitting a single branch on the way down. So I feel uncomfortable criticising other people's art, given that anything I would have attempted would be 1,000 times worse. In what follows, if I am critical at all, it's in relation to the composition or the content of the art rather than the ability of the artists themselves. The good. My first impression was the cover for issue 26. And what a first impression. What a cover by the great Ian McCaig. I think my fate, my love of White Dwarf magazine, was sealed right there. An obsession with RPGs that survived a deep freeze and is still there 40 years later. I still get a Proustian rush of excitement when I see it, taking me back to those teenage years and the thrill of discovering these games. In the painting, a party of adventurers, in the act of stealing an egg from a dragon's nest, are interrupted, caught by surprise as the mother dragon returns. There's a great deal captured in this picture. Adventure, spectacle and drama, with the returning dragon beautifully portrayed, about to attack, and the adventurers suddenly realising the danger they're in. It's a great example of depicting an adventure in action. You're pitched right into the middle, your imagination engaged. Just exactly what you'd want from an RPG magazine cover. So, what other covers were standouts for me? Well, a few choice highlights. Let's start with Peter Andrew Jones's wonderful cover for issue 76, which has more than a whiff of the exotic about it. Two adventurers ride on the back of a giant eagle as they approach a castle in the sky. It really conjures thoughts of Arabian adventures, perfectly capturing the excitement and the spectacle of exploring strange new landscapes. A sense of the spectacular is also present in the cover for issue 46 by Gary Mays. A city-sized spaceship fills the sky, dwarfing jet fighter in the foreground. Epic. Now, I know that some grogs won't thank me for including it, but I really like John Sibbick's cover for the original Warhammer 40,000 rulebook, reused for issue 93. It features a hardened brand of space marines of the Techno Womble vintage fighting a Rorke's Drift-style desperate defence against unseen assailants. I'm pretty sure the attackers are orcs. That, or disgruntled White Dwarf readers moaning about the dwindling RPG content. It's a picture with real impact, dumping you into the action as the bullets fly, and a great encapsulation of the game. The artwork of the late great Chris Achilles featured on the cover of White Dwarf no less than 13 times. A feast from which to choose. I've always liked the picture he used for 60. A knightly duel in the snow, with an imposing medieval castle as a backdrop. Two armoured knights are caught just as they engage in combat on horseback. A fair damsel clinging to the back of one of the riders. Drama, confrontation, chivalric romance, all captured in a single wonderful image. Another prolific cover artist was Games Workshop's very own John Blanche. His style is always instantly recognisable. Never more so than issue 42's cover depicting a fantasy city of a shadowy, grimy alleyways down which a fortune and danger both lurk. This picture alone counts as a major influence on the tone of the future Warhammer fantasy roleplay. A perfect mix of grimdark with the promise of high adventure. Science fiction artist extraordinaire Jim Burns provided a great image for issue 32. The pilots of a crashed retro-style aeroplane are confronted by a huge lion-like beast advancing towards them with hunger in its eyes. The little laser pistols they are armed with look woefully inadequate. It's a beautifully composed picture. Les Edwards is an amazing artist with a particular gift for horror, I think. Who can forget his chilling, crogling vampire used in the Games Workshop Call of Cthulhu hardback? His painting, used on the cover of issue 19, featuring a spindly ghoul emerging from an Egyptian tomb straight towards the viewer, is similarly unsettling, carrying a particular air of threat and menace. Everyone a winner. There are so many more I could have picked out. Apologies if I've missed your favourite. Please send all complaints on a postcard to Dirk and Blythe. The Bad. White Dwarf's RPG heyday was of course the 1980s, a period which unfortunately coincided with an era of the chainmail bikini in fantasy art, and not forgetting its science fiction counterpart, the spray-on spacesuit. The influence of Frank Frazetta and Heavy Metal magazine loomed large. It seemed, whether they were fighting monsters, riding winged beasts, or giant mechanical mosquitoes, or just simply exploring, women in fantasy art had real trouble hanging on to their clothes. White Dwarf was guilty of these poor representations a number of times. The most egregious example was, of course, the cover for issue 44, featuring a near-naked female warrior battling a winged demon. With the benefit of 40 years hindsight, it's obviously rather crass and offensive. But even at the time, it drew complaints in the letters page of subsequent issues. Plus, friend of the show, Dave Morris, cheekily complaining about the depiction of naked monsters. As Oliver Dickinson noted, if I was about to face a fearsome demon in combat, I'd want more for my protection than a pair of nipple tassels and some kinky boots. The picture was by the artist Alan Craddock, although it was mistakenly attributed to Jim Burns in that issue. This was corrected in a later issue, but misreading that for many years, so I always thought it was an uncharacteristic Jim Burns piece. It's even signed as Alan. I'm not sure why I never noticed that. Maybe my teenage attention was drawn elsewhere. Ah well, I'd like to think we've all matured in the intervening decades since. And then there was issue 100. For issue 90, the 10-year anniversary issue, John Stivick produced a superb painting of the White Dwarf himself, looking mean and indomitable, resplendent in his armour, leaning on his trusty axe. Well, the 100th issue was arguably an even bigger milestone, so surely this was also due a major celebration, with a cover pulling out all the stops. No, What we got was no artwork at all. Just models. Photographs of models. Heresy. Okay, there was a little cameo from John Stivick's dwarf from 10 issues earlier, but no, just no. This was deeply uninspiring. Not the White Dwarf I knew at all. Many RPG diehards regard White Dwarf 100 as the final issue. That cover was certainly a nail in its coffin. What else? Well, there's several other covers that weren't really to my taste. Often where the subject of the picture seemed rather static and unengaging. But just because I didn't like them, should they fall into the bad category? Well, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, and as I've said before, I'm in no position to judge. So let's move on to the odd. On occasion, the cover of White Dwarf could be accurately summed up in one word. Bonkers. Who can forget Nicholas Bibby's four-winged bat thing eating blobs of purest brown on the cover of issue 30? Not me. Adventurers riding unlikely beasts were also popular. We had both curious stag beetles, Eddie Jones, issue 22, and an angry-looking chickens, Christopher Perrigo, in issue 9. But many of the weirder covers came from the artistic brush of the singularly named Emmanuel. They gave us, deep breath, a shouty man with an afro riding a giant lizard. Or was it a tiny man on a normal lizard? Issue 14 anyway. A shifty looking cleric type trap being squawked at by a large bird. Issue 25. A naked youth with butterflies for ears holding a lightsaber and looking at spots of blood on the ground. No, really. Issue 37. And a pair of bulbous-headed aliens looking enigmatically off to one side. Issue 40. I don't know what Emmanuel was smoking, but I'd like some, please. Throughout the whole RPG heyday, White Dwarf magazine brought us a succession of eclectic and idiosyncratic fantasy and science fiction artwork on the cover. More varied, more exciting, and at times just downright more strange than any other games magazines of its time. Whoever was responsible for picking the images to be used on the cover came up with some truly memorable choices, time and time again. Sometimes the cover image hinted at the features contained in the magazine. At the other times, it could leave you scratching your head. But at their best, they really captured that unique mixture of excitement, danger, and wonder that we all associate with role-playing games. And who could ask for more than that? So don't keep them hidden away in that golden wonder box. Get them out. Share them with family and friends and revel in the weird and wonderful world of the White Dwarf covers.
Thunder Phase!
Welcome back to a Thunder Phase, where we take some questions from our listeners. And I've got quite a few here, actually, Blithey. So without further ado, what I've done, I've put them on cards.
Okay.
And apparently at random, I'm going to go through them and shuffle them. Some of them have been there for a while, actually. The ones that people have given us previously, and we haven't got round to them. So let's see what we can do in the next 40 minutes or so. Are you ready?
Yeah. Go.
First one.
Thunder Phase.
Oh, here we go. Let's start, as we mean to go on, with a quite a controversial one. Why is role-playing social media discourse so repetitive? And has it got worse or better? And that's from Kiha.
Well, you could say that about social media generally.
I do think, I mean, this isn't a good thing to say as podcast hosts, but there are certain subjects that get hit on repeat, aren't they, within role-playing. And there is only so much you can say about some things. And recently I attended Symposium in London, which is very fancy. I went to went to an art gallery, and it was this place which was
went to an art gallery. You said that as if some whippet breeders who've never been to one before. I went to that London. I went to an art gallery. Well, did you? What were those art galleries?
Oh yeah.
Anyway, carry on.
But it was one of those. It was one of those art galleries.
One of those art galleries with art in.
Yeah. Well, it didn't have any art in it. That was the thing. It was one of those that was like all concrete.
Well, you say that. You say it's no art in it. Maybe it's got art. You didn't identify as art.
Maybe I was the art. Maybe I was the art.
Maybe you were the art. Maybe the tables and chairs were the art. Or even just the concrete was the art.
Yeah, it was. It was like one of those, you know, those sets from a youth program in the 1980s on Channel 4. Felt like I was in the middle of one of those.
Yeah.
And it was a day. It was a really pleasant day. And it was good to be in a rarefied place thinking about role-playing in a different way. However, the topics were fairly familiar. They were about things like immersion, how much lore is too much lore, world-building, you know, what do we do to make these things up? And, you know, you spend a day on social media and in the churn, these things will come up as part of role-playing discourse. And Stu Horvath was present. He was being beamed live from the swamps of New Jersey, and he's got a new book out, and he made the point that role-playing games resistant to theory. And what he meant by that was, you know, you might postulate on some things and think of best practice and put forward your views on them, but at the end of the day, what you're doing yourselves with your friends around the table is entirely up to you. So no theory is going to penetrate that or make a difference to that. And I think there's some truth in that. And I think that's why sometimes the discourse does seem repetitive.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think that's something he's put it very eloquently. It's something that we've talked about quite a bit in the pub between ourselves. The fact that you're absolutely right. You are generally playing these things, apart from conventions, put conventions aside. But you're playing these things with your friends, aren't you? So you might, we've now established regular gaming groups and we do our own thing. And the people in that group, we've all acclimatized to doing what we're doing in the way that we're doing it, and we all enjoy it. And the problem with social media is, I suppose, people go on social media and give their views of this is how it should be done. But really what they're saying is, this is how we do it. This is how we do it. And this is how we like doing it. But that often gets either misinterpreted or is put forward as, this is how you should be doing it.
Yeah.
But that's not how everyone wants to do it. And you just, as you said, that's not how everyone has to do it, because you're doing your own thing. And we know, don't we, from our experience, that we play with different groups of people, and the games we play with them are slightly different because of what that group has become accustomed to.
Yeah, and the personalities that it's composed of, what that group particularly enjoy playing and how they enjoy playing.
Yeah, yeah.
No right or wrong to it,
and you realize as well when you find yourself maybe at a convention in the midst of what you are considering is a bad game, it's often because the people around you are playing it in a different way that you don't really care for. So it's not necessarily bad. It's just they're doing their own thing and, you know, they kind of outnumber you. So you're the odd one out. You're thinking, oh, I don't really do this kind of thing.
And I suppose the other part of the question is, has it got worse? And I do think there is a bit more of a performative absolutism about some of the statements that people make.
Yeah.
And is that because in the context of an attention economy, the more performative and absolutist that you are, the more attention you get?
Yes.
So is it getting worse as more people seeing that and doing it more?
Yeah, I think there's an element of that to it. Yeah. Like you say, it's repetitive because there's only so much you can say about them. And some of the conflict does come from that, I think. I've seen things on social media from people, not people I know personally, but people, accounts that keep cropping up on a timeline that I look at and I think, I don't really know what you're going on about here. I don't seem to know quite what you're quite all that upset about. You seem very upset, but I'm not sure what. And it's a bit of a rabbit hole then, because what I do is I click on the thread and start looking at the thread and thinking, why are you so upset? Why is this argument kicked off? And sometimes it's impossible. It's impossible to get to the bottom of what's really going on. Maybe that's my age, I don't know. But sometimes people, like you say, have these like performative arguments and outrage, and I'd look at it and think, what are you all upset about? I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see why people are upset, because they've started having a go at each other. But when you kind of backtrack to what sparked it, I'm never sometimes genuinely not sure what's caused it.
And we mentioned last time you've taken a conscious decision not to participate as much in social media. I still do.
And I think maybe what Keha also has hit on about the repetitiveness of it is sometimes that the fact that certain types of social media, so like X, Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it.
Formerly known as.
They're not great spaces to have meaningful discussions. And so the reason it becomes repetitive is because maybe people are just defaulting to the same stuff because it doesn't lend itself to a longer or more kind of exploratory discussion about these things. So things just, people might start off wanting to discuss things in a wider context or in a deeper way, but ultimately, because of the very nature of it, it just defaults back to the same old stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's part of it. It's a big part of it.
Yeah. That's a good one. Thanks for that, Keha. And it makes pleasant change to the usual one he sends, which is, when are you doing Flashing Blades?
Flashing Blades? What's that? He's never mentioned that before.
Thunder Phase.
This is an interesting one. Have we reached peak TTRPG? Is the hobby going to continue to grow and flourish over the next few years? And that's from Dave Castle.
Yeah, that is a good question, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to judge. I think we've made the point before that I've hardly got the finger on the pulse of what's happening now. My head is still in the 1980s, you know.
You've been talking about White Dwarf covers. I mean, come on.
Exactly. I've just gone over the fact that Imagine shut down so suddenly. So,
we're the wrong people to really have a view on the future, aren't we?
We're not entirely locked into the past. We do look at the present day. I think from a personal point of view, it feels like I'm certainly gaming a lot more now than I did back then. I'm playing more diverse games. Mm. And even though it slowed down a bit, because obviously there was a peak of releases over the lockdown period, I still feel like it's growing and it's still present. There's still a lot going on.
I think it's quite a difficult one to assess, because going back to the past, we thought that role-playing was dead when Games Workshop switched to Warhammer and we lost interest in it. And part of us losing interest in it was because we thought it was dead and gone, because our only real sort of link to it was through Games Workshop and White Dwarf. And when they shifted to Warhammer miniatures and that kind of thing, we just thought, oh, well, that's the end of role-playing then. And of course, it wasn't dead at all, was it? It was thriving just in different places and different spaces with different people. So I suppose it depends on your perspective, doesn't it? I mean, I've certainly stopped backing Kickstarters. There was a point where I was backing Kickstarters left, right, and center. And now I'm far more kind of restrained with it, because I've had not necessarily bad experiences. The things I've got through Kickstarter have been great, but they're sitting on a shelf, not unplayed. And I do look at them and think, why did I bother? Now, is that an indicator of anything? I don't know. I don't know whether it is or not. It's an indicator of my experience with terms of I'm buying. If you're looking at it from a marketing perspective, from an industry perspective, I am buying far less than I bought 2 years ago, 3 years ago, even pre-lockdown. I'm buying far less because I'm getting to a point where I think there's a few games that I quite like playing and running a lot, and I don't know if I want to buy this or that or the other. So, but I don't know whether that indicates any kind of trend. I don't know, because it's just me.
I suppose what might have provoked the question is that there has been some recent debate, fueled by Ben Riggs, the historian who we had on the podcast last year. And he was observing that Wizards of the Coast are moving away from a publishing model, a book publishing model, towards a online model where they want to cut microtransactions and create a world that people buy into and subscribe to online. So is that analogous to what happened with Games Workshop? So the idea is that as they shift their business model to a new market or a new way of promoting themselves, will that leave people behind? And will people assume, oh, D&D stopped now, and so therefore the hobby stopped? I'm not sure it will, because I think it's in a different place, isn't it, than it was back in the 80s. I think there's a lot of other things going on other than what's happening with D&D.
I've no real sense of how many people play it. And when I say how many people play these games, to what extent, this sounds odd now, it can sound strange, but to what extent they're like committed to it, or whether they're just fair weather players, or the people who dabble in it for 6 months and then not bother with it. It's an odd one to assess, isn't it? Because it's clearly more popular than it's ever been. And it's clearly become a bit more, not so much, a bit more mainstream, hasn't it? So, you know, you'll see articles in The Guardian or The Independent. And of course, there's been the movie made. So that kind of suggests that far from tailing off, it's kind of in the ascendant. If Hollywood's making a movie of D&D, that suggests it's very popular. But I don't know what that really means for the hobby. Is that just almost a separate thing completely? That popularity with D&D is it completely separate from the other worlds of role playing, the worlds within worlds? So it's a difficult thing to assess, isn't it? It's like the death of rock and roll, isn't it? You know, people keep saying it's happening, but of course it's still going.
You can refer back to the answer we were giving to the previous question, that ultimately it'll come down to your own experience of it, and whether it feels like it's growing or fading or not. And there are still people joining Virtual Grogmate who have never played online before. So they contacted me to say, what do I need to do? This is my first time I've done it. I'm just getting into it again after a period of being away. So still people coming through, and there are people who have dropped off, and they've dropped off because they've had that initiation start and they've got their own group. So they've probably got no time for Virtual Grogmate anymore, because they've got their own thing going on. So there is a sense that it's still thriving, it's still going on, it's still happening. And that's my personal experience. And that's, I suppose,
like I said at the beginning, it's the problem is your personal experience. Even in the world of social media, where you can, I suppose, unlike when Games Workshop shut down, or changed rather in the back end of the 80s, unlike those days, you can dip into this world and look into other people's experience through social media. But even so, there's still a lot of it is down to your personal experience and how you think the hobby's going and what you're involved in. And that, I think there's plenty of life in it.
Thunder phase.
What is the most ridiculous weapon one of your PCs had? And that's from Steph.
I would say, and this could be controversial, I'm sure many military and medieval experts may write in and complain about this. But I'm going to say the old flail. The flail is a ridiculous weapon. It's a stupid. It's stupid, isn't it? You know, you go into a dungeon and you're playing a cleric or something and you've got a flail.
That's your first issue, isn't it?
That's my first issue, because it's often the cleric. But even it doesn't have to be a cleric, does it? People walking into a dungeon with a flail, so that like a stick with a chain and a spiky ball on the end. Now, why on earth do you think that's a good idea? How is that a good weapon in a sort of, maybe on horseback charging at someone swinging it? Fair enough, it might work, but in any other situation, it's useless, isn't it? someone's coming at you with a sword. Hang on, let me swing this ball around and try and hit them with the ball.
Wasn't part of the thing of a Morningstar flail and a flail is that they were fairly easy. You didn't need any training to use them. And they were quite horrible to face when they were being swung.
I don't know.
You say
you don't need any training to use one. I think you would, wouldn't you? I mean, take your eye out, your head off.
But do you not just, you kind of flail it around in front of you just to scare people away more than anything?
Yeah, it's still rubbish, though. That's still rubbish, isn't it?
You're
a mighty warrior in a role-playing game, and you've got a ball, a spiky ball on the chair. It's rubbish.
One of the things that always strikes me when I look at a weapons list, and there are games, aren't there? And I remember Tons and Trolls was a good example of it, but there are others that go for exhaustive lists that have got a level of authenticity to them, so they match real-world weapons and they describe them fully well. And TNT, you learned so much, didn't you, about what weapons were available. However, in a fantasy world where your main opponent weren't other human beings, they were actually monsters, wouldn't weapons develop differently to tackle the vulnerability of the monsters that you had to face on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, if you lived in a town where there was some kind of manticores or something like that, would you develop particular weapons that dealt with manticores better than you're right.
So with a manticore, you'd want to ensure that you got length. So the stinger's your biggest threat, isn't it? So
exactly,
what you probably have is a spear that incorporated some kind of shield on the end, so that you had some shield and you could poke at it, but also flick it up to pull the stinger back.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
I'm making it up as I go along. But
obviously,
my point is that the evolution of weapons would be entirely different in a fantasy world than it would in our Earth world, where we don't face monsters.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. But in a game, one of the things with weapons in a fantasy game in particular is certain weapons have a certain glamour. Those swords are just like cool, aren't they? People imagine, oh, I've got a sword, or a bow, Robin Hood bow, flail. Just rubbish. Stupid weapon. I'm sure they have the purpose, and I'm sure some expert will be able to point out that they are a fantastic weapon because, maybe a skilled person with a flail swinging it around, you can develop a kind of almost a shield, a wall of a spiky ball swinging around like a shield that no one's going to get near you because you're swinging a spiky ball. I'm prepared to concede that may be the case, but in the spirit of the question, in a role-playing game, when I'm imagining my character using a flail, it just always seems a bit stupid. Rubbish compared to the guys with the swords or the battle axes.
One weapon that I remember, and we didn't have, wasn't one of our PCs that had it. It was another member of the party. When Herbs joined our group, he brought along some of his friends, and Winnie had character that he allowed, Herbs allowed Winnie to have a Java Blast. And a Java Blast, for people at home, for our overseas listeners, as Rory Stewart says, our overseas listeners, a Java Blast was a huge crossbow that could fire javelins. And his human-sized character, wasn't he? He was big, but he had a crossbow that could fire javelins. And the javelins he had in his boot.
That's right. He said they were in his boot and they were at an angle so that he could walk with these things in his boot. And it was just like raised eyebrows all around, wasn't it? A very ludicrous concept this was. Yeah. Absolutely ridiculous. So he could fire. And I did it because like a javelin, but he had I think he let him have like the crossbow damage plus the javelin damage, didn't he? What he did. So it was like 2d6 plus a d10 or something like that.
Ridiculous. Outrageous.
Ridiculous, yeah. Absolutely ridiculous.
Thunder phase.
How do you feel about games based around TV and film franchises? Are there any that you would like to see? And that's from our friend, Film Fan Mike, 68.
Mm.
How do you feel about Gaines' best friend film and television franchises, and are there any that you would like to see?
I have mixed feelings about them. I think there are some that, depends on the TV show, doesn't it? Some lend themselves very much to role-playing. So I think like Star Trek RPG is great from that perspective, because Star Trek's just, well, you can just do so much with it, can't you? Boldly go where no one has gone before, etc. Off you go in your spaceship, meet aliens and alien races. It's, you know, limitless possibilities. Whereas others, I'm less sure of. So, for example, I got some PDFs, copies of the Walking Dead role-playing game. And I look at that and thought, it just seems limited, doesn't it? It just seems such a limited kind of game. You know, it had some interesting ideas in. But after a few sessions, you just get a bit bored of it, because it's just zombies, isn't it?
And that's won by Free League, and they've kind of perfected, haven't they, recently? They're the ones that have gone for the big name franchises like Blade Runner and Alien.
Yeah.
And you could say the same thing about Alien and Blade Runner. Gets leveled.
Yeah, you could.
Once you've replicated what that can do, what else can it do?
Yeah, that's it. What else can it do? And what else would anyone expect to do? I mean, this is always one of the jokes with Alien. I mean, it is actually a great game. You know, we've played it, haven't we? And had quite a bit of fun with it. But I must admit, it sits on my shelf now. And I look at it and think, I think I've kind of done that, really. Because, of course, as you say, you've either got aliens in it. But if you don't put aliens in it, people go, where are the aliens? So I think to me, it depends on the nature of it, the film or TV show. Some films and TV shows are great. So a good example, Terminator. Terminator 2 is a great film, isn't it? But it's very limited in scope. From a role-playing perspective, what would you do with that? Just strikes you as quite limited. Whereas other TV shows, I suppose, have a wider range, don't they?
I think there's always this conflict, and maybe you're going to take this ready-made world and ready-made content that you're going to purchase. Mm. So the world's been made by films and television. So there's like a set of assumptions around the table that know what the Star Trek universe is, or Star Wars universe, or whatever it is. Everybody got an idea of what it is. So is that enough? So do you just come in with your Savage Worlds and toolkit type rules and make it yourself? You know, just say, right, this is in the world of Star Wars. But it's a lot of work to do that, isn't it? It's a lot of work to create that. So is there appeal of saying, yeah, well, go on, I'll get the Star Trek rule book, because it'll
it gives you everything you need in game terms.
The second part of the question is about what would you like to see? And I have no real desire to see any particular franchise. When I see something on TV or film, or even when I read a book, generally, when I look at it, I don't particularly look at the setting or the characters in the setting. It's more about the situations that they're in that I think, how would I deal with that in a role-playing way?
Yeah. The same way you can look at a particular film or book and you don't necessarily think, oh, I want to play in this universe. You just think, the situation in this universe is interesting. I could take it and use it somewhere else. Yeah, yes. I would agree. I can't really think of any franchises I'd want to see as a role-playing game. In some ways, the best films and books are quite a narrow concept, aren't they?
Yes.
So I don't know if these things do translate. I mean, we talked about this with Blade Runner, haven't we? You know, we've not played Blade Runner yet, have we? And it'd be good to play it maybe, but again, to what extent, how much mileage is there in it?
Yeah.
You know, once you've hunted a few replicants, or maybe been a replicant, been hunted and that kind of thing, how much mileage is there in those things? And I felt like that with The Walking Dead. I did look at it and thought, it's a similar kind of feel to Mutant Year Zero. So it had that idea of building a homestead and, you know, building a settlement. But there was part of me just thinking, Mutant Year Zero is more fun. There's just more things can happen in it. Whereas in this, it's just zombies.
There is something about a setting that's been created for gaming that is have got the edge over some of these TV and film franchises because it is a gaming world, so it lends itself to some of the things that you can do within games rather than as part of a TV drama.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think that the things that work in cinema and TV and book don't necessarily work in games, and the things that work in games don't necessarily work. Because they're different mediums, aren't they?
Yeah.
When I'm watching a film, whilst you might think of things in it that are useful for gaming, when I'm watching a film or reading a book, I'm having a different experience to a game. So it doesn't necessarily follow that that film, for example, however good it is going to necessarily translate well into a game setting.
No.
In the same way, sometimes that, you know, and you see this with computer games, when they make a movie out of a computer game, don't they? And it's terrible because, again, a game doesn't translate back into a film. That was everyone's, I mean, the D&D film was great. It was really good, but that was everyone's fear with the D&D film, wasn't it? That you're sort of moving a game into a different, completely different medium. And that's when it can fail. And the same's true the other way around, that you can take something from a novel or a book and it just doesn't really work.
If you take my favourite, it's still my favourite TV series, is the Sopranos.
Mm.
But I have no particular desire to be in the world of Tony Soprano. And I don't want to necessarily encounter the characters that are in there, you know, Sylvia or Polly Walnuts. I don't really want a game where you meet those people, but I'm compelled towards the situations that they find themselves in and how you would replicate those in games.
And
and I think the other example that I've given, and we've talked about this recently, haven't we? I'm reading a book called American Dirt, which is a Mexican narcos crime thriller, which is brilliant. And there's a game called Cartel, which is set in the world of Mexican narcos fiction. And I just can't, it does not appeal to me to play in that world because it's too real. It's too intense. I wouldn't like the feeling of being around a table of people participating in the level of violence that is required in that world. However, in this American Dirt, it is somebody fleeing for their lives across Mexico to get into America. And it did make me think about, in a game, how would you do that? Because player characters, when they're being pursued by something, there comes a point where they do an evaluation of risk and think, I'm going to confront it. Whereas the odds are so against this woman who's trying to flee that that isn't an option for her. And that's where the thrill is that her constant need to escape is the thrill. And so that's the thing that excites me when I read books or see films or TV series, is thinking about how would you do that in a game? How would you get that so that making that long-term chase feel appealing and exciting in the same way that this novel is?
Well, that's a good example, isn't it? Because, as you say, the game factor in the scenario, the situation that character's in a game, are dealt with very differently potentially by the players.
Yeah.
Whereas dramatically, it's more exciting if she's on the run in a novel. But in a game, that might not be what the players want to do. Potentially in a game, might not be the most exciting way of dealing with it. It's a different thing altogether.
And the only way to deal with it is actually to create a mechanic that rewards somebody for running away rather than confronting it.
I can't really think of anything. I was tempted to say Blake Seven, aren't I? Because I drop that into everything. It would be good to have a Blake Seven role-playing game if anyone's listening. You know, just for me, really. You'll get one sale. You get one backer on your Kickstarter. Me. Mark as well. He likes Blake Seven. Two. You got two Kickstarters there.
Any more?
Any more? Two. Three.
Fair warning. I'm going to close this one now. Next
Blake
question.
Seven role-playing game. Three backers.
I'm Steve, host of All Aunt Rex's Gaming Vexes, a podcast documenting my ongoing mission to run or at least play all of the RPGs that I seem to be incapable of stopping myself buying.
And you'll see me frequently fiddling with something in my hands.
Each episode, I get together with a group of fellow gamers that have either played a game I've run or who've GM'd a game for me. We chat through what we've enjoyed about the game and some ways we could have improved the experience whilst making a series of terrible jokes along the way.
Was it hot chat action?
Sometimes we con game designers who really should know better to come along and talk to us about their games and maybe run an actual play segment to give us an idea of their vision for their game.
I've told this story before, it won't bore anyone.
Our topics range from old school favourites like RuneQuest through to some of those newfangled narrative games all the cool kids talk about. When you listen, I want you to feel as though you're sitting around our gaming table, taking part in our post-game chat and helping dispose of the last of the crisps and ale.
I'll just wax my bowstring and think about the death of the tainted.
Oh no, 898.
So, if you like listening to people droning on excitedly about games in a range of regional British accents, All Anthrex's Game of X's is the pod for you, and you'll find it on your podcasting app of choice. On occasion, you may even hear something really insightful, but I'm making no promises. Over to you, Dave.
Point to Ponxes and make it a Titan.
Keep it eye.
It might have seemed like an abrupt end to Thunder Phase, but we went on and on and on for nearly another hour, so watch out in your pod box because I'm going to release it separately very soon. At the time of writing, I'm getting ready for Virtual Grogmeet, our online version of the annual meetup. There are some great games on offer, and I'll be interviewing a special guest, Dan Whitehead, about ZX Spectrum games on Sunday, the 21st of April at 11 a.m. Thank you for listening, and to all the Patreon supporters, old and new, for throwing coins in the beret to keep this show on the road. You won't have to wait too long for the next one, and I'll give some shout-outs to recently joined supporters. Hold your breath, for more of this Bobbins will be coming at you sooner than you might like, proving that you can have too much of a good thing. Adios, amigos.
Sick. I could definitely drop to that one. All we need now is like a hook line. You know what? I've got actually the perfect one. Bassline. Oh, wicked. Now put a donk on it. Electro. Oh, that's sick at me. Put a donk on it. Techno.
Oh, no, that is good.
Put a donk on it.
Hey, that's good, that Tony.